Hello and welcome to The Rounds Table, a weekly podcast about major new research in medicine. My name is Amol Verma. I'm a resident in internal medicine at the University of Toronto, and I'm joined today by Nathan Zilbert, who is a resident in general surgery, also at the University of Toronto. Hey, Nathan, how's it going?
Very well, Amol. Thank you. How are you?
I'm good. I apologize if I'm a little bit less than eloquent today. I just finished my Royal College exam this week, and I may be operating on fewer than normal number of brain cells.
Excuses, but congratulations on that major accomplishment.
Thank you. Let's reserve congratulations until we have some results of the examinations, but for now, I will take the brief reprieve from studying. And I'm delighted to be doing our podcast again.
Absolutely.
So today, Nathan and I are going to be talking about two articles. I've chosen not to do a clinical pearl this week because I'm all pearled out, but we'll come back to them next time. So we're going to get right into it. And then, of course, as always, we will conclude with our good stuff segment, bringing you short and sweet recommendations from the world of medicine. So first, we're going to talk about an intervention to reduce the rate of cesarean section deliveries in Quebec, Canada. And then second, we're going to talk about the treatment of alcoholic hepatitis and specifically a randomized control trial of prednisolone versus pentoxifilin. So Nathan, why don't you kick us off and tell me a little bit about this intervention to reduce C-section rates in Quebec?
Thanks very much, Amol. So I'm going to be talking about this paper that came out in April of this year in the New England Journal of Medicine by a group of obstetricians from our neighbors in Quebec, as you mentioned, that did a study looking at how a quality improvement initiative implemented at hospitals and compared to a control group showed a modest reduction in C-sections in the province. So I think it's somewhat obvious what some of the issues with an increased C-section rate include. Basically, you're trading a normal vaginal delivery for a major abdominal procedure. And the consequences of this include longer length of stay in hospital, a longer recovery, increased costs, potential wound issues like infection and hernias, scarring, and other issues that make it a less desirable intervention in someone who doesn't need it. And there's been a trend of increasing C-section rates in Canada over the past, or at least the first half decade of the 2000s, increasing from 20% to 28%, which was some of the background that these authors were interested in.
That's a pretty dramatic rise, Nathan. Any thoughts on why this happens? Do people think it's sort of inappropriate use of C-sections? And I guess that's the underlying assumption.
Well, I think that's the underlying assumption. You know, they don't address it specifically, but if I go back to some of the comments made during my obstetrics rotation, which occurred in a different environment, actually, in New York City, and some of my dinnertime conversation with my obstetrician father, I think, to just be brief about it, I don't want to get into this too detail. I mean, I think just the reality is that these women are being monitored very closely, and there's a hesitancy to let time elapse if there's anything that shows up on their monitoring that would be resulting in any concern for the baby. And so I think the threshold becomes maybe quite low to proceed with the C-section when in many cases, or at least some cases, if labor were to have been let to continue, the baby would be okay.
Interesting. Okay. So complex, and I'm pleased to hear Dr. Zilbert's, the senior's take on this. And maybe, I don't know if you, did you speak with him about this paper at all?
He was overall not too impressed.
Okay,
we can get into that when we talk about the effect of the intervention.
Yeah, let's get into it. Okay, so tell me what was the study here?
So they randomized 32 hospitals in Quebec to either an intervention, quality improvement initiative, specifically looking at appropriate C-section use compared to normal standard of care. Prior to the randomization period, they began collecting data on rates of both maternal and neonatal outcomes, and specifically measuring the type of delivery done. And that was continued. The intervention period was a year and a half, and it was preceded and followed by a 1-year period of data collection, which resulted in a pre and post comparison analysis. And basically, this was done over 32 hospitals in Quebec, half receiving the intervention. Over just over 100,000 deliveries were involved. And the intervention results were that those hospitals where the intervention was conducted had a 1.8, bold, underline, exclamation point, 1.8 absolute risk reduction in the rates of C-sections as a consequence of their intervention. So what do you think, Amol?
1.8% out of like 23% baseline, right?
Yeah, so the baseline rates were approximately 23% in each group.
So I have to say, I'm not sure what to make of the 1.8. So it seems like an awful lot of effort. I'm very impressed at the scale of the intervention. You know, 1.8% is not necessarily something to be quibbled with. We're happy with a 1.8% absolute reduction in the rates of myocardial infarction, for example. Like, you know, that could be a very clinically significant rate if we're talking about like an intervention that's so common, like the C-section.
Yeah, so first of all, let's talk about what the intervention was. But I mean, I do think that we're talking about over 100,000 women. And so, you know, a 1-2% reduction, you know, we're talking about maybe, 1,000 people that didn't need to have a major operation. So I don't know that it's entirely trivial, but I mean, it's obviously not a dramatic change. So, I mean, I think it's definitely a fair point. So let's talk about the intervention a little bit. So basically what they did was they had a local opinion leader within each institution give the whole, sounds like, labor and delivery team, the obstetricians, the family physicians, the nurses, an in-service where they reviewed the latest Canadian guidelines on appropriate management of labor and delivery, specifically focusing on C-section use. And then they had a committee struck with two or three or four people at each institution, again, including obstetricians, nurses, and GPs, that served as an auditing committee. And they basically reviewed all the C-sections in the first month of every quarter and determined the local rates of C-sections and reviewed the specific cases and provided feedback. Both they describe somewhat vaguely informal and formal feedback to the members of the healthcare team to try and, provide teaching around each of the cases that were done in that first month. And so in the one-year intervention period, this would have occurred four times for each of the quarters of the year. And then in the post-intervention year, those randomized to the intervention were encouraged to maintain this practice, but they received no ongoing external support from the investigators, which they did receive during the intervention period.
Okay. So it seems like a pretty straightforward education-based and then some audit and feedback intervention. A couple of, I guess, initial thoughts come to my mind. First is, what are the hospitals that these people are working in? What were the sort of characteristics of these hospitals? Was most of the obstetrical medicine being provided by obstetricians or family physicians? And did this affect the outcome?
So the hospitals, in order to meet criteria, all had a rate of 300 deliveries a year and a C-section rate of at least 17% with no specific quality improvement programs ongoing for C-section reduction. So those were their inclusion criteria. And they had over 32 hospitals ultimately sort of deemed eligible for this. But when they attempted to randomize and they wanted to stratify based on hospital size and community versus academic, they resulted in 32 total, 16 in each group. So regarding your second question, in both groups, the rates of deliveries performed by family physicians was about 40%. I did want to point out that they did some auditing of adherence to this auditing and feedback protocol. 25% or four of the hospitals randomized to the intervention were not found to be compliant with the intervention itself. So when they reanalyzed with just looking at those hospitals that were compliant, the effect was larger, as you might expect, increasing to 3.4% absolute risk reduction. And another point that I think was interesting was that when they separated their analysis between high-risk and low-risk pregnancies, which they didn't specifically define their criteria for those terms, the effect was actually not seen in high-risk pregnancies at all. which I think is somewhat interesting and maybe, you know, is suggesting that maybe there's more appropriate C-section use or a different threshold for C-section use in pregnancies deemed to be high risk, and the area for improvement seemed to be in those of low risk.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. I mean, you know, the obvious, I guess, thought process is that there's inappropriate use of C-sections in low-risk deliveries, and, you know, that is something that could be avoided, and perhaps in high-risk deliveries, the rate of C-section is wholly appropriate. One of the questions I was wondering is, you know, they have, you know, 30 to 40 hospitals at their baseline measurements. Do they comment on the variation between hospitals in terms of C-section rates? Because that might point to an opportunity for intervention if there was dramatic area variation in the rates of C-sections. I couldn't really see much about that in their paper.
No, neither could I. And, you know, in trying to piece together, you know, bits of that, so their inclusion criteria were that hospital had to have at least a 17% rate of cesarean section. I'm not sure where they got that number from. And then, again, the baseline rates, they don't break it down hospital by hospital.
So I guess one of the concerns might be that if you're reducing the rate of inappropriate C-sections, are you also perhaps reducing the rate of appropriate C-sections? And so did they look at maternal outcomes and, you know, were they improved or harmed? And what about neonatal outcomes?
So they looked at both maternal major and minor morbidity and similarly neonatal major and minor morbidity, and they found no changes in maternal morbidity at all. And actually small improvements in major neonatal morbidity, but quite small, and no change in minor neonatal morbidity. So it didn't seem that reducing these C-section rates, you know, modestly, for sure, caused any changes, significant changes in complication rates for mother or baby. Now, you know, a couple of things that I think we've noticed here was that in the introduction of the manuscript, they talked about the national rates of C-section increasing from 20 to 28%, like we mentioned. But the baseline rates here in Quebec, in both groups, were around, you know, 22.5 to 23.5%. And I do think that in the United States, the baseline C-section rates are, you know, over 30%, I think due to the medical legal climate there with an even lower threshold to proceed to a C-section. So I wonder if there may be other jurisdictions in Canada and maybe other jurisdictions in the world where the rates of inappropriate C-sections are higher and where an intervention like this may result in an even larger effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, and there was no real data about cost-effectiveness of this intervention here in this study. We can assume that reducing the rates of C-section is going to dramatically reduce costs, but, you know, whether the offset of those costs is enough to cover the cost of the program itself, we don't know any information about that, right?
Right.
Okay, so Nathan, why don't you give us a one-line summary of the paper?
So the one-liner is that this quality improvement initiative that included both in-services and audit feedback practices did result in a modest, call it 2% reduction in the rates of C-sections in hospitals in Quebec.
Okay, thank you so much. So I wanted to talk about alcoholic hepatitis, a study called the STOP-AH trial. It's either STOP-AH or STOPA. So I think I'm going to go with STOP-AH.
You are the man when it comes to trial acronyms as far as I'm concerned. So however you want to say it, that's how I'm going to say it.
All right. Well, I appreciate that vote of confidence. So this was a double-blinded randomized control trial that studied patients with alcoholic hepatitis and found that the two recommended treatments, pentoxifilin and prednisolone, didn't have particularly impressive effects. Pentoxifilin did not improve outcomes for the patients at all, and prednisolone may have improved short-term but did not improve long-term outcomes.
Okay, so maybe before we get into the details, you can walk me through a little bit about the specific patient population that this was looking at. Were these people with acute or chronic alcoholic liver disease? What was the outpatient, inpatient? What was the kind of group of patients that we're talking about here?
So this study was specifically examining patients who presented to hospital acutely and were diagnosed clinically with alcoholic hepatitis. So acute hepatitis from alcohol intoxication. As you might imagine, many of these patients, if not all of these patients, had chronic alcoholic liver disease. but this was specifically about their acute presentation for alcoholic hepatitis, which meant that the clinicians felt that the hepatitis was not from another cause. So when patients present with acute hepatitis, acute alcoholic hepatitis, we evaluate or grade the severity of their hepatitis using something called the MADRS discriminant function. It's basically just a score of liver synthetic function. And patients who have severe hepatitis or significant liver dysfunction have very high rates of mortality. And most clinicians, based on clinical practice guidelines from associations like the American Association for the Study of Liver Diseases, recommend treatment with either prednisolone or pentoxifilin. The rates of mortality in these patients who have severe alcoholic hepatitis are really high. So historically, they've been reported as being between 20 and 30% within 1 month of their presentation, around 40% within 90 days, and up to 50 to 60% at 1 year.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's an important and morbid disease in these patients. And so the evidence, however, for the use of prednisolone or pentoxifilin is quite poor. The largest RCT to date for prednisolone was only about 90 patients, according to the authors in this trial. And it's controversial whether the benefits, in terms of the anti-inflammatory effect of specifically the steroids, outweighs the risks of infection and bleeding that might be elevated with it.
Okay. So exactly what did they do in this study?
Yeah, so this was a multi-center randomized control trial. They included 65 hospitals in the United Kingdom. It was double-blinded, and it was a 2x2 factorial design, meaning that they were studying four groups of patients effectively. And they enrolled patients who were admitted with this clinical diagnosis of alcoholic hepatitis and a severe score on their MADRS discriminant function. And the patients were randomly assigned to one of four groups, either pentoxifilin alone, steroid alone, both pentoxifilin and steroid, or just placebo. And all of the patients were treated for 28 days.
While admitted to hospital for 28 days, or this could be continued as an outpatient?
Yeah, that's right. So it could be continued as an outpatient.
And can you give us a sense of the biochemical abnormalities that a patient might have it to qualify them to be severe on that scale? Like what kind of...
Sure. So I'll tell you the average characteristics of the patients that were admitted in this study. So their prothrombin time or their INR was more than double the upper limit of normal. And their MELD score was on average something like 21. And I think... as you know, you might know better. So the MELD score for a cutoff of consideration for a transplant is like 15, right?
Yeah, 15, 16. So, yeah.
And so this study was powered based upon that to detect a difference in mortality from 30% to 21%. So they were basing their power estimate on a predicted 30-day mortality of 30%. Okay, so let's talk about what they actually found. So they found that their overall 1 month mortality rate was actually 16%, so about half of what they had expected. And effectively, there was no significant difference in the pentoxifilin group. And in the prednisolone group, the odds ratio of death was low, like 0.72, so 72% odds of dying, but it didn't quite achieve statistical significance with a p-value of 0.06. And then when they looked at longer-term outcomes, there was no effect on survival or transplantation at 90 days or 1 year.
So what do you think about that that prednisolone effect? I mean, are we splitting hairs by saying, oh, p-value 0.06 instead of 0.05? Do you think maybe the study was underpowered, or do you think this is actually a negative result and should be considered along with the... pentoxifilin as not of any therapeutic benefit?
Yeah, so as all the statisticians who may be listening or involved in this might sort of roll over at this, I think it is splitting hairs, but let's be honest, it's like the critical hair that we always say needs to be split in terms of meeting your significance criteria. So technically we haven't split that hair. We have not met our significance criteria of 0.05, right?
Right.
Having said that, I think that the study was somewhat underpowered given that they were predicting or anticipating a 30% mortality rate and they saw roughly half of that. It does seem like there's a bit of a trend towards benefit. Now, the prednisolone was not a harmless therapy, as you might imagine. There was a higher rate of infection in the prednisolone group. 13% had infection as opposed to 7% who did not receive prednisolone, which was a statistically significant finding.
Okay, so the drug that definitely didn't help also definitely didn't cause harm, and the drug that maybe helped definitely caused some harm.
Correct, which puts us at a bit of a Hippocratic dilemma, Nathan.
Yes, prima... Et cetera.
Non nocere, or something like that. Okay, Latin we are not. So, you know, overall, this is an important study because this is a morbid condition that we're seeing all too frequently. And, you know, the best available evidence previously suggested that we should intervene. And now, I mean, I think this study certainly tells us that we should not be using pentoxyphylline. There seems to be no benefit at all. And in terms of using the steroids, it's a bit of a toss-up. It may improve your 30-day outcomes, but is unlikely to improve your outcomes at 90 days or 1 year. It sort of calls into question whether that should continue as clinical practice.
Yeah, so I mean, what do you think? I mean, my kind of bias with the caveat that everything I know about this really is coming from what you're telling me, but my bias would probably be to not...
You have an excellent source.
To not... to not use it. I mean, it doesn't affect the long-term trajectory of the illness. So it's not really a disease modifying per se. There's short-term harm and morbidity, it sounds like, with increased infections. What do you think you'll do the next time you see a patient like this?
I'm going to do what the American Association for the Study of Liver Disease tells me to do. No.
So status quo until they revise their guidelines based on this trial.
No, I think that I will never, I will not use pentoxyphylline for sure.
Uh-huh.
And I'd have to think about the prednisolone. No, I do believe that there's a trend to benefit. I have to say,
in 30 days. Only within 30 days.
But sometimes that 30-day that might matter. And the argument is probably in the longer term, you know, the ongoing use of alcohol is what removes any benefit, right?
Right.
And so, you know, I'm an optimist. I think people can change. We can do our best to help them, live healthier lives.
Help them help themselves.
Yeah, that's right. I'll make one quick point, which is that the thing that stuck out for me in this study, and I spent a lot of time trying to understand more about this, was the fact that the average time from admission to initiation of treatment was like 6 or 7 days. And I would argue that for an acute condition like this, you know, that might be a significant time difference that might be mitigating some of the potential benefits you might have seen from earlier initiation of therapy. And I couldn't for the life of me figure out exactly why that was the case and, how that might have had an effect on the patient's outcomes.
Yeah, I mean, seems like an important point that might need to be clarified before really getting too gung-ho about the findings. I agree with you.
Okay, so let me summarize by saying that this large randomized control trial basically demonstrated that pentoxyphylline does not improve outcomes in patients with alcoholic hepatitis, and prednisolone may have a beneficial effect on short-term outcomes, but did not improve 90-day or one-year outcomes for patients with acute alcoholic hepatitis.
Great, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Okay, so Nathan, time for the best part of our show. Tell me what caught your attention from the world of medicine.
So, do you know how many countries, Amol, in the world have universal Medicare but no universal pharmacare?
Phenomenal question, and I'm going to say one.
You're so wise.
Is that right?
Care to shout it out?
I'm going to guess it's our very own home and native land.
Yeah, so that's absolutely right. So in a recent issue of the Canadian Medical Association Journal, there was a study trying to explore the economic impact of a national pharmacare system in Canada, given that we do sit in this unique spot of having the pride and joy of our healthcare system, being that it's publicly funded with the, you know, big asterisk caveat of not for medication. So they did some sophisticated analyses looking at how this would affect overall government, provincial and federal government spending. And there were a lot of different assumptions that were built into this that could be adjusted. But basically, incremental cost to the government would be either modest or potentially result in savings, which is interesting. How could they save money by implementing such a system? So the main ways that the government would save money with the national farm care system would be the economies of scale from increased purchasing power, and also not having to pay for private insurance for all the civil servants. And this was accompanied by an editorial basically kind of saying, you know, enough is enough. It's an interesting editorial because the author quoted like two or three of his own previous editorials from the past, you know, 5 or 10 years, you know, continuing to beat this drum. But, you know, the ethical and moral and social benefits of such a policy, I think, kind of go without saying. And now they have some compelling economic analysis to go behind it, too. So it was a good couple of papers in this week's National Journal.
Thank you. Good recommendation. So from my side, Nathan, how many specialties exist for which you have no idea what the title of that specialty entails in terms of job description for medical specialties?
Me as a doctor or me as a random citizen?
You as a random citizen.
Oh, I don't know, 20?
I have to say, as an internist and soon to hopefully be general internist,